Turn again to Habakkuk, please, as we continue in this wonderful little prophecy that is so applicable in all times and all seasons of Christians' life and the life of the church in general. Certainly no less so today, and perhaps in many ways more applicable to us as we look around us and see many things that we would like to see different, that we would like to see the Lord change, that we would like to see reviving come and just do away with iniquity and bring forth righteousness. And Habakkuk certainly was pleading for that among his people. And the Lord had an answer, but it was not the answer that he expected, in that God was going to use a wicked band of people, the Chaldeans, as his instrument to bring forth that spiritual work that was needed in his people, to bring them to repentance and restoration. So today we're going to go into chapter 2, the first part of it. But to set the stage, I'd like to read, first of all, verses 1 through 3. Then we'll jump down to 12 and 13, and then we'll pick up with chapter 2. The reason I want to do it that way is, again, to remind us about Habakkuk's complaints to the Lord, and then his response in himself as we begin the second chapter, what he feels is necessary as the prophet for him to do, because there's great lessons for us to learn there as well. So again, in chapter 1, verse 1, the burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? Even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Why dost thou show me iniquity, and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are those that raise up strife and contention. Verse 12. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, mine Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment, and O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and cannot look upon iniquity. Wherefore dost thou look upon them that deal treacherously, and hold thy tongue when the wicked devours the man that is more righteous than he? Chapter 2. I will stand upon my watch, and set me upon the tower, and will watch to see what he will say unto me, and what I shall answer when I am reproved. And the Lord answered me and said, Write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. May the Lord bless the word to us again today. Well, the prophet, after complaining to the Lord, and we have noted that he complained in the first four verses, then there was a response that God gave beginning in verse 5 down through verse 11. Then the prophet responded with an argument toward the Lord, as we just read a portion of in verse 12, which goes all the way down through the end of the first chapter. And now as we start chapter 2, we have the answer that the Lord gives. But before we get to the answer, which is actually in verse 2, we have to consider what happens with the prophet in verse 1. And that's where I want us to spend a good bit of our time in this hour. Now, we have also noted the prophet is perplexed about God's working, or lack of it, in this situation. He is wondering at God's unexplained indifference toward evil. At least it seems to him he is. At God's unexpected practice of dealing with heathen to accomplish his holy purposes. It just doesn't seem right that the Lord would use wicked people and let them do their wicked designs, and God would, in essence, bless that and allow it to take place. And then now, as we begin chapter 2, here's the third part of the prophet's perplexity over God's work. He is perplexed at God's unhurried purpose. God's just not in a hurry to answer his prayer, to do what he desires to see done. And so God's unhurried purpose gives Habakkuk even more to contemplate and more to be upset about and more to wonder at the real motives of God and the work of God in this situation. What is God really up to? The prophet, in essence, is asking. Now, once he's come to that point, reality sets in. And the prophet realizes that he may have spoken a little bit out of turn to the almighty dread sovereign of the universe. In other words, he may have overstepped his bounds just a tad in his arguing with the Lord. And that settles in on him. And so as we begin chapter 2, the prophet is sobered up by that and decides he's going to take maybe a step or two back from the line that he drew in the dirt for the Lord and say, well, maybe I need to kind of be quiet for a minute. And that's exactly what he does in saying, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and watch what he will say to me, and then what I will answer, not if, notice, but when I am reproved. In other words, Habakkuk expects the Lord to reprove him for his sort of brash dealing with the Lord about the problems that he sees. He really realizes, I've probably stepped out of bounds here, and God is going to let me know that in no uncertain terms. And so the best thing for me to do is stand here and take my medicine like a man. God is certainly justified in rebuking me, condemning me, punishing me even, disciplining me in some way, because I've really dealt pretty handily with the Lord in this. Now, here's the thing about it. Even though Habakkuk feels that way, we can tell by God's response that actually he has not overstepped his bounds. Because there is no rebuke given to the prophet. In fact, a task is given to him. He is given an important mission as a spokesperson for God, and God in no way challenges him and says, who do you think you're talking to? Now, we could debate all day long whether or not God should have done that. Certainly he could have done that, right? But that was not his response. And what we need to read into that is a great, great, great amount of grace poured out upon the prophet and his people. And to remind us that while we certainly need to always speak reverently to the Lord, humbly before him, sometimes when times are tough and situations are critical and our emotions get the best of us and we blurt out something, we don't have to fear that God has a lightning bolt with our name on it ready in his bag to send and to smoke us into oblivion. That's not how God deals with his people. Could he do that? Sure. Maybe should he do that sometimes? Perhaps so. And we have examples where he has. But here God wants the prophet to know that in spite of what is coming upon his people, that God is a God of love and mercy. And his people that are in covenant with him should never have a horrifying fear of God, but rather a reverential respect and submission to him. They should never be afraid that if I step across this line, God's going to kill me. Now, there are certain lines you don't want to step across. But in the sense of just simply complaining to the Lord, crying out to the Lord, venting our frustration, we have many, many examples in the Bible. And in most cases, we see the Lord responding very kindly and graciously instead of destroying those who would dare to ask the Lord, what are you up to? Why are you doing this? You're too righteous to do these kind of things. So it's a valid exercise for the child of God, but it's good, I would come full circle and say it is good that the prophet in himself thinks maybe I've spoken out of turn. It's always good for us to have that mindset. Okay, that's not bad in itself, because that will help keep us reverent and humble before the Lord. Now, what is all this about standing upon his watch and upon the tower? It could be taken literally, and it may mean that the prophet actually went up into an overlooking tower to kind of view all the people and all the things that were going on from a higher vantage point, and therefore just to kind of get away from the crowd and to have a solitary moment so that he could hear God speak clearly above the din and noise of all the sin and evil and injustice that's going on. That certainly could be actually true, that he really went up into some kind of tower. However, it's more likely that his language here is symbolic of the fact that he realizes in order to really begin to understand, not that he'll ever get there all the way, but to begin to understand to some degree why God would use the Chaldeans against his own holy people to accomplish his purpose, the prophet realizes, I really need to see these things from a higher perspective than I'm seeing. In other words, I need to get up where God is. I need to look with a heavenly perspective down upon the situation rather than looking very much in the horizontal, which I'm doing now, and just in the midst of everything, looking around me, never looking up, or certainly not looking from higher down, and therefore I'm drawing some wrong conclusions. So the prophet realizes what's needed most, this is important now, what's needed most when we don't know what God is up to or why He's doing what He seems to be doing, and we have some severe problems with it. We are in a very crisis situation. We're crying out to the Lord. We're confused. We're hurt. We're doubting. Then the best thing to do is try to see things from God's perspective. Get on God's level as much as is possible for man to do. Another grand example of this is Isaiah. When the prophet looked at the situation in his nation and saw that now the king, who had been king for so long, had perished, and the people were wondering, what are we going to do now? We don't have a godly leader anymore. The prophet makes sure that he enters into the place of worship to seek God. He realizes that if I'm going to be any good to my people and to get benefit for myself, I've got to get where God is. I've got to see things from His perspective. And so in chapter 6, you know what happens. He goes to the temple and God moves in and he sees the Lord. And then all he's left able to do is say, forget all the problems outside here. I've got enough to take care of within myself. Woe is me, I'm undone. So Habakkuk realizes in a like manner that in order to get to the heart of the issue, he's got to see things from God's perspective. And so he seeks spiritual elevation. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and watch to see what he will say unto me. Go over for a minute to Isaiah to chapter 21. Let me give you a little comparison here. Isaiah 21. Look at verse 4. My heart panted. Fearfulness affrighted me. The night of my pleasure he hath turned into fear unto me. Prepare the table. Watch in the watchtower. Eat, drink. Arise, you princes, and anoint the shield. For thus hath the Lord said unto me, go set a watchman. Let him declare what he sees. And he saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen, a chariot of asses, and a chariot of camels. And he hearkened diligently with much heed, and he cried as a lion, saying, my Lord, I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime, and I am set in my ward whole nights. The unnamed person of the Lord here, maybe Isaiah, most likely it's someone else, another prophet or someone, is spoken to by the Lord to get into the tower and to watch what's happening. Now again, this could have literally, physically happened, but the spiritual picture is still there very clearly. And it is that this person, like Habakkuk, is told by the Lord to get apart, get away from the situation, get up high, and look down upon it. And it's amazing how the perspective changes when you look from on high. No doubt, when we are able to see in the physical realm from a higher vantage point than low, we can see many things that we miss otherwise, right? If you're in a plane that's flying at a level where you can visualize a lot of things on the ground, and you go over the same turf that you always are used to and travel in and live in, it looks radically different. And you see things that you could never see from the horizontal plane. Now, the spiritual situation is that way as well. And it's necessary then for us to go up in order that we may look down with wisdom. And in essence, I think the Lord really, although it's not stated here in direct words, I think the Lord probably put it in the heart of the prophet to do this, to look from a high vantage point, in essence to say, Habakkuk, come up here with me. Come and see from my vantage point and you'll understand much better what I'm doing. Now you won't understand it all because I'm God and you're not. But you'll understand a lot better than you do right now as you're down in the dumps, in the dirt, in the dunghill, looking around. And God graciously gathers His prophet up and says, now, here's my vantage point. You see how things look different? See how things take on a whole new meaning when you see it from a heavenly perspective? And I would submit to you, dear ones, that the greatest hindrance to us accepting the Lord's providences in our lives, when they're not the kind of providences we want, when they're what the old guys would call cross providences, the greatest hindrance to us being able to embrace those, as Habakkuk's name implies, is because we don't see it from the heavenly perspective. We only see it from the earthly. We're only concerned about our own flesh and the flesh of those we care about and how it's impacting them and our overall situation down here. Rather than seeing that there's a sovereign God who is working all things after the counsel of His own will, and all things indeed do work together for good to them that love Him and who are the called according to His purpose. The prophet must be brought, and he's willing to the place of this sort of perspective. So, he goes to a place of spiritual elevation. But secondly, he gives patient attention for the Lord's speaking. He says, I will stand here and set me on the tower. I'm not going to be active. I'm not going to be moving around. I'm not going to be talking and doing this and doing that. I'm simply going to listen. Patient attention. I will watch. I will look out, literally in the Hebrew. I will look forth to see what He will say to me. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? You'd think He would say, I will listen carefully to what He will say to me. But He says, I'm going to look for what He'll say to me. Bringing two senses together. The eyes and the ears. In other words, to stress the fact that when God speaks, things become clearer. When God speaks, our vision, our spiritual vision, is enhanced. And so He says, I'm going to look for what God's going to say. Sort of like the phrase the psalmist gives us, taste and see that the Lord is good. How do you taste and see? Same idea. I will look out for what God will say. And so patient attention is absolutely necessary. I'm going to resign myself to listen and not speak. And probably again, and I'm certainly at great fault here in my own personal life, but probably again for most of us, that's another problem. If the greatest hindrance to us dealing with the providences of God is that we simply don't see them from the heavenly perspective, then under that, a subheading would be, a lot of the reason we don't is because we're doing all the talking and no listening with God. And Habakkuk says, I'm through. I've said my piece and now I'm going to listen. And notice he doesn't say if he will speak to me, but I'm going to see what he will say when he speaks. I know God's going to speak. And if I'm not quiet in my spirit and in my lips, I may not hear. So I'm going to pay attention. Go over to Psalms for a moment. First of all, Psalm 73. Verse 15, the psalmist realizes that there's a point, as the writer of Ecclesiastes says, a time to speak and a time to be silent. Verse 15 of Psalm 73, if I say, I will speak thus, behold, I should offend against the generation of thy children. When I thought to know this, it was too painful for me until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their end. He says, I was going to speak, but that would have been detrimental for me and for everybody else that belongs to God. And so I'm just going to listen. And I'm going to go into the sanctuary of God. And then I'm going to understand the end of the wicked. That even though they get to have their day, and the Chaldeans are certainly fixing to have it with Habakkuk and his people, their end is sure. Now, chapter 77, Psalm 77. I cried to God with my voice, even to God with my voice, and He gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble I sought the Lord. My sore ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. And boy, you talk about a phrase that'll preach. I remembered God and was troubled. We would think it ought to say, I remembered God and was comforted. But that's not what he says. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Thou holdest mine eyes waking. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. He just got through talking about how much he's spoken. Then God brings him to the place where he can't say anymore. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I commune with my own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. Once again, someone who begins speaking to the Lord and cries out to Him, and the psalmist here even says, He heard me and responded, but then He brought me to the place where He in essence said, you need to be quiet and listen. Commune with your own heart and be still. In other words, do some introspection. Look inward. probably 400 years ago, there was an excess in some areas with some people about introspection. In other words, they looked in too much. But fast forward 400 years, and the problem is 180 degrees from that. Most people don't look inwardly at all. So the problem has gone completely the other way. And the psalmist says, that's when I was benefited, when I turned and looked inward and listened for God. So he says, I will watch to see what he will say to me. And that's a confident expectation. Spiritual elevation, patient attention, and then a confident expectation to watch what he will say to me. God's going to speak. I know it. Now, here's the great benefit that we have over the people of bygone days, such as Habakkuk. And that is this. We have the completed, full, and final revelation of God in our hands. And so, dear people, whereas in Habakkuk's day there was some of the scripture written down, but also things that were happening, things that were in progress in their lives, in that day, they had to listen for God to audibly speak. Now, a lot of times we think, boy, wouldn't that be better? That'd be great if God just spoke out of the sky and told us what to do. Well, I don't know that we could handle it. I don't even know that we could handle it as well as some of them did in that day, if he did. But here's the point. We have it better than them because you never have to say, I've got to wait and sit here with my arms folded and see if God's going to speak. In fact, you should never say that. Why? Because you have a Bible. And he'll speak. Get it open and get into it. And pray and seek the Lord's face. And you'll be guaranteed even more so than Habakkuk was. I'm going to watch to see what he will say to me. A confident expectation that God's going to speak. Now, I'm guilty too, so I'm with you on this, but I'm here to tell all of us that anytime we come to our Bible with less than the expectancy that God is going to speak to our hearts, then we have blown it. We should never open this precious book without already having in our mind that God is going to speak directly to us. Because he will. If we're in the right frame of heart and mind, if we're listening, if we apply ourselves. And sometimes we all know this too. He'll speak even when we're not. Right? When it's just a casual reading and we just think, oh, well, it's my duty. I haven't read my Bible today. I've got to read a few verses. And we have the whole scenario in mind to crack the book open and read three or four verses and be on our way. And all of a sudden, God grips our heart and says, hold on just a minute and listen to this. Have something to say. Maybe a word of rebuke, maybe a word of comfort. But the thing is that God's going to do that. But again, here's what we must do. We must set ourselves in such a frame of heart and mind that when we come to this book, we know God's going to speak to us. If you can't do that, don't open it till you can. Until you expect God to speak. The prophet was sure of it. And then he says, and what I will answer when I am reproved. Exhibits finally a holy resolution. As I said a moment ago, it's not a question of if God is going to rebuke me. He will. And so I just need to be praying about what my response to that will be. And at this point, I don't believe the prophet is fomenting another argument to be ready. In other words, that when God says, now Habakkuk, if he does, you shouldn't have spoken like that. I don't think the prophet's already planning and saying, well, yes, I should, because you're not doing what you ought to be doing. I think he's formulating a response to say, yes, Lord, you're right. I've overstepped my bounds. I lay my hand on my mouth, as Job said. I have dared to speak but this once more, as Abraham said, in regard to the twin cities, Sodom and Gomorrah. Now I'll be quiet, because I'm but dust and ashes anyway. That's really what he's prepared to do and say. And that's right and good. The wonderful thing is that God does not rebuke him at all. After he voices this holy resolution, expecting reproof, expecting to be challenged by the Lord that he has spoken out of turn, the Lord answers him in verse 2 and says, here's your task. Here's your assignment. No word about what he has complained about. No challenge from the Lord about him perhaps speaking wrongly about God, as Job's friends did and were rebuked for it. But rather, okay, Habakkuk, I've heard you. Now here's your task. Here's your mission. Write the vision. Make it plain that he may run that reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, and it's going to come. So the charge is given for him to go forth with a vision. Write the vision. Which once again reminds us, as I've already said, how much better off we are than those folks were. He's going to have to pen something that God is going to display before his eyes and put in his heart and mind. Whereas all we have to do is read what's already written. The visions have been committed to writing that we should have, right? Everything necessary for life and godliness is right here in these 66 books. And so our task is simply to have a teachable spirit and read the writings of the vision. They've already been committed to eternal truth, to be sustained forever, settled in heaven, right? But Habakkuk has got to write it down and then run with it. He's got to carry the word to the people. And the word is almost an exact opposite of what God has set up to this point, which we will see in successive times. And that is that as he describes the Chaldeans, God does to Habakkuk in these following verses of chapter 2, and talks about everything they do that's evil, the Lord decrees they're not going to stand. I'm going to deal with them. I will bring them down. As I heard an old preacher say one time, preaching about this from a text in another place in the Old Testament about the Chaldeans and Babylonians, he said, if you think God didn't make good on his word, go find a Chaldean today and show him to me. There aren't any. Just like there aren't any Ninevites, right? All right, we could go on and on. So, the word that is the vision to be written and carried forth is exactly opposite to chapter 1. At least is the way the prophet looks at it. Wait a minute, God. You're going to bring these Chaldeans, these wicked people. You're going to strengthen their hands and allow them to accomplish their purpose upon us, to lay waste to your covenant people. And then you're going to kill them when they get through. Now that, dear ones, is certainly cause for a lot of head scratching when you begin to perceive it. And what it does is set in clear relief the absolute sovereignty of God. Who again, as you've heard me say over and over again, is so sovereign, he can use pagans to accomplish his holy purposes, and then when he's through with them, he tosses them aside like a used up tool that is no longer fit for anything. That's the God we serve. And so this vision is good news, even though the bad news has already been given. That the Chaldeans are coming and they will do their wicked work, but they will not prosper because of that. And because, remember back in chapter 1, we talked about it in verse 11. He says, speaking directly about Nebuchadnezzar, his mind shall change and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power unto his God. God marks right there, here's what's going to bring them down. It's because even though I allow them and strengthen them to lay waste on my people, because they will honor themselves and sacrifice to their net, as Habakkuk says there in the first chapter, God says, that is detestable arrogance in my eyes and abominable idolatry, and they will pay for it. And somebody say, well, they're already pagans, but how else do you expect them to act? Again, it shows that no man is without excuse, as Romans 1 reminds us. And the very thing the Chaldeans do that they couldn't do without the sovereign hand of God, they are still accountable for, and they will face judgment for it. Sort of like Peter pointing his finger at the gathered Jews on Pentecost and saying, this man was delivered up to you, Jesus Christ, by the predetermined counsel and foreknowledge of God. Now, if he paused at that point, he may not have in his preaching, but if he did, I could just see the Pharisees go, whew, boy, I'm glad to hear that. It was all God's work. We didn't have anything to do with it. We were just puppets. If he paused at all, he didn't pause long, and the rest of his sentence was, and you, by the hands of wicked men, took him and nailed him to a tree. You're responsible. Wait a minute, I thought God sovereignly did that. Right. And you're responsible. And that's exactly what he's doing, going to do with the Chaldeans. So, what do we glean from this? I didn't really get into God's unhurried purpose, so we'll save that for next time. But the point is that we must have a heavenly perspective in order to, in any way, begin to understand and appreciate those works of God that seem so contrary to us, to His nature. I mean, let's face it, it just still doesn't make practical human sense that God would honor and use, and we could even use the word bless, heathen people to do wicked things. It doesn't make sense. And so, in order for it to make some sense, we have to go into the sanctuary so that we might understand their end. We were talking about this the other night with some folks. Remember that the godly man's hell is only the trials and afflictions that he suffers in this life. The person who belongs to Christ, that's all the hell they will ever endure, is the troubles of this life. The wicked man's hell is an eternity in flames. And the only heaven he ever gets is whatever good times he has in this life. Right? That's the extent of his heaven. That was the extent of the Chaldeans' heaven, when they could have their will and way with people around them and take them over and plunder them and lay them waste and subdue them. And they thought, we're on top of the world. Only for them ultimately to perish and are still burning and ever will burn, Nebuchadnezzar and all the rest, in eternal flames. So that's the way we need to get our perspective balanced, isn't it? Look from God's vantage point. Look down. And wait to see what God's going to say. Be confident that He will speak. And resolve to take whatever He gives us and run with it. Not walk, but run. Because it is that that must be published for the sake of God's people. All right, we've got about 5 minutes or so before we need to stop. So any questions or comments today?